reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. I'm going to call our third case for today, which is a case that had been scheduled for an earlier month. And we're delighted to see both counsel well. Welcome home, Mr. Castle. Mr. Hurdle, we want to thank you for your courtesy in not objecting as to the scheduling and doing your best to fit both Mr. Castle's, yours, and the court's calendar. So, 2004 AP 2010 CR State versus Lionel M. Anderson. Representing Mr. Anderson is Harry R. Hurdle. Representing the state will be Jeffrey Cassell. Mr. Hurdle.
May it please the court, Mr. Castle. My name is Harry Hurtel. I represent Lionel Anderson in this matter. Mr. Anderson, as the court is aware, was convicted in Milwaukee County arising out of criminal charge of sexual assault. In this instance, I've worked on this case now for quite a while, and it has continued to look to me like the elephant situation where everyone looks at it and touches parts of it and understands parts of it, but as a whole creature seems somehow to be something more than what people have claimed it to be. In looking at the trial court and looking at the Court of Appeals and in Mr. Castle's arguments, what I have seen is the idea that this particular creature in the form of this trial had to it parts which were of great significance, but were totally missed during the course of the original trial, during the original assessment. There was no understanding of the fact that by law, pursuant to 97104, Mr. Anderson not only had the right, but the mandate that he had to be present during his trial, and that his trial, again by law, incorporates all communications between a judge and a jury. In this instance, Judge Sankovitz, who from everything I have heard is a tremendous judge, but in this particular instance, somehow failed to understand what is an extremely basic principle in criminal trials, that when there is a judge and jury communication, it is necessary that counsel be advised, that the defendant be present, and that before there be a response to the jury, there be an opportunity for input. In this particular case, the general answer to that that has permeated the case is that's okay because even though all of this was wrong, we've looked at it and we conclude that somehow it is harmless error, that under the circumstances it is appropriate that Lionel Anderson be convicted. That conviction is based upon a review by the trial court, the Court of Appeals, by Mr. Castle. And I keep looking back to the right to be present at trial. Each time that reassessment is made, Mr. Anderson is essentially being told, you asked for a trial of your peers, you asked to be present at that trial, you weren't given the chance to be present at the important communication between those peers and the court, and then in retrospect, folks who did not see the witnesses on the witness stand, people who did not hear the inflections of voices, people who were not present when any of this was before the court, are having to review the record and make a conclusion that says, no harm, no foul.
Counsel?
Yes.
You seem to be suggesting that this constitutional error, and the state, I think, has conceded this is a constitutional error, is not subject to the harmless error analysis, and I think our cases would suggest to the contrary.
Well, I think that in most instances that would probably be a fair assessment, although I think if I read State versus Harvey's incorporation of Netter versus United States accurately, there's the definition of harmless error, but there's also a contrast that certain errors are so structural that they require automatic reversal. And I certainly don't want to say that every communication between a judge and a jury would fall into that category. And I also don't believe that the court here should be denied the option to say this is one of those things that is not a structural error so inherent to what we expect in our trial system that it mandates or requires an automatic reversal. But what I do see that to me is to some degree unique but likely to be repeated is the use of the videotape that was submitted to the jury for the full replay as a result of the first request to the jury, one that was presented to both the counsel and ostensibly to the defendant prior to the evidence being submitted. In a sense, when you take a structure of fairness and a trial by peer and you replay what is in essence the entire testimony, as I noted, Mr. Castle referred to the tape 11 times when he was talking about the evidence of the state. You take that, and the jury comes back and says, we need the counterbalance, the other side of the scale in making our decision. We want to hear what the victim said under oath, and we want to hear what the defendant said. And you have a judge not telling legal counsel, not letting the defendant be a participant, and you simply say, well, you let me know what it is you don't remember, or you let me know what it is you don't understand. And then after the jury gives up, the bottom line is that you have taken part of that structure, a mandatory right of the jury, a mandatory right of the defendant, and you have yanked it away in a scenario where, through the power of modern science, they have already seen not once but twice the side most favorable to the state.
Counsel, how long was the testimony of the defendant?
The actual defendant's testimony from a time standpoint, I would not tell you, be able to tell you without checking the record. It was 25 double-sided pages. I would anticipate it would have been less than 25 minutes, but I don't have the minutes and I can't tell you, Judge Crooks. I'm sorry that I can't.
The reason I ask the question is because obviously one of the considerations of a circuit court judge looking at this request is what kind of time are we talking about? Are we talking about several hours or days of testimony or, like you said, maybe 20 or 25 minutes? That obviously goes into the discretion that is with the circuit court judge.
And I think most circuit court judges would know from their experience, like yours, that when that happens, having counsel there to weigh 25 minutes, folks, you know, if as a judge one thinks that's too much, then you can pare down the summary so that it's fairly transmitted to the jury. But there's that input, that chance that's described in one of the federal cases I made note of, the power to prime the pump of persuasion, not to be too alliterative. That aspect of it is important, I believe, in the judge making that decision. Yes, the length of what's there may affect whether it's to be submitted.
Would you be here if the judge had simply said, sure, let it go in, but the lawyers weren't there, and there was still a conviction?
In my opinion, the fact that the jury has the right to the testimony to be reread would trump a defense argument that it should not have been read to them without their input. However, I also believe that the fact there isn't notice given still violates the statutory mandate of the defendant's presence, and you have this other statutory requirement. I believe it's under 805.13. It's got to be on the record. So you certainly would have those competing influences. But I'd be less concerned had the jury gotten the testimony, because then that balancing of the videotape is no longer as paramount an issue.
Because as a practical matter, you realize when you have trials of substantial length, and the attorneys say, call me, and one is 10 miles away and the other is 15, and the jury has been deliberating, I think the judge would have some leeway. But here, as I take it, you're concerned because there was not a balance. There was a videotape. There was nothing else for the jury to consider other than their own memory when they had already asked for the transcript.
Absolutely. And the court may not think a policy is necessary for every situation, that the case-by-case determination makes sense. On the other hand, I'm a little concerned when the Court of Appeals says this is prohibited, that this is a requirement, and we just urge the courts to do that, as published right now, the Court of Appeals decision says if you don't do it as a Court of Appeals, I would strike that as a circuit court, and someone later who hasn't seen the witnesses decides, well, the person under the evidence here appears to be guilty and the harmless error test is going to fall on the side of the State, there is not a lot of incentive to wait for those folks to come back from their dinner or to make the, oh boy, ubiquitous cell phone call that was referred to in Judge Coffey's opinion. I think that from my courtroom experience, defense attorneys ought to be standing by just as prosecutors do. Lunch is understandable, but you're there for the client. And in a sense, the trial is for the client. The jury's there for the client. It's his one chance. And in that chance, justice, it's described as blind, but it shouldn't be deaf to the request from the jury saying, please give us that to which we're entitled. And it certainly shouldn't be mute in saying to defense counsel nothing when it should be speaking up and saying, this request is here. That procedure, that process, is something relatively simple in the context of what has happened to Lionel Anderson.
One of the issues of some dispute is whether or not this constitutional error, that is, the right of the defendant to be present at trial, should be analyzed under ineffective assistance of counsel because there was no objection after apparently the jury had reached a verdict and was coming down, and then the court put on the record the two requests by the jury for the testimony. But then there was no objection. So should this be analyzed under ineffective assistance of counsel?
No, and I do think this is one area where the court can probably address the fact that if there is an issue involving presence at trial, that the question of some type of colloquy or waiver involving the defendant should be mandated. In essence, it would make sure that if there were a jury communication, there'd be awareness on the part of at least the defendant, and hopefully his counsel if he's stuck around like he should, or she should, pardon me, that guarantees that there is not going to be a loss of a very important right. I had plucked out my plea questionnaire from the office this morning before I left that I probably fill out with my clients 5 times a week when people waive their jury trials. And the detail involved in making certain that a defendant understands what's being given up is extremely strong in that document. The rights are enumerated at great length. And not only is that covered by me with my clients, but the judges I appear before make certain they've covered it all in addition with the form in front of them, with the signature on it, to be certain that the person understands they've given up a right involving what a jury can do for them and a right for what they could do in a trial to which they're entitled. Once a person elects to have the trial and someone takes part of it away, is it fair to say that if the lawyer gets up there and is asked, anything you want to put on the record, and the lawyer says no, that that's the same as if the judge said to the client, you understand you have a right to be present when I talk with the jury, and in this instance it'll be in writing, and your attorney has a right to be present to provide input. Do you wish to be present, or would you instead prefer to waive that or give up that right? I see no harm in that colloquy. As a matter of fact, I see only a benefit. And the reality of it is that in this instance, what defense counsel did at the time of trial was essentially ignore what has brought us all here, which involved well-stated principles known to most folks. And Mr. Anderson is essentially being held to the standard of proving that this affected the outcome of the case because of something that he had no involvement in, involving his right, not his lawyer's, of a constitutional magnitude. And I understand lawyers can waive those in trial on occasion. I don't believe presence at trial involving judge-jury communications should be easily waived, much less waived after the fact. And to me, that's locking the barn after the horse is out. Even if there had been an effort to try to say, I object, judge, let's give the jury the transcripts or rather the testimony, By that time, they reached a verdict. They're ready to go home. You can't solve that ignoring of the need to communicate and provide what the jury asked for, and you certainly shouldn't hold Lionel Anderson accountable for what was perhaps a truly inexcusable error on the part of his counsel. Everyone in this case agrees what happened was wrong. It's just what should be done about it and how the standard should be met.
Mr. Hertel, now let me ask. On two occasions, not only was the defendant not present, it's also true the attorney wasn't present. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right.
And no notice given to the prosecutor either.
Neither attorney was present. And I understand that in discussion of some of the, and you raised the issue of structural errors and whether or not this is subject to any harmless error test. My understanding of the law is that if there's a complete denial of counsel in a trial situation, that you have a structural error. Here we seem to have a denial during a portion of the trial. Has the court, either this court or the United States Supreme Court or any other court, rule on whether or not that constitutes a structural error?
I hope the light bulb appearing over my head wasn't that obvious. As soon as you said that, I thought, isn't there something I should have looked up? Because that makes a lot of sense as to whether it is in its entirety or simply as a portion. I guess my feeling is that the right to trial and presence at trial is so inviolate that any portion of it in which the right to counsel has been denied should trigger that structural flaw.
Well, you have cases that say if you're not counsel not present at sentencing, that's not a good sentence.
That's true. And, of course, if the defendant's not present, he gets a resentencing because he has to be there.
Mm-hmm. Either way.
Yeah. And the same statute which governs those issues of defendant's presence governs the trial itself at which the communications occur, and the constitutional right for a defendant to be properly represented implies not just ineffective assistance, but actual assistance or the opportunity for actual assistance.
We have, though, some Court of Appeals cases. I have right in front of me the Kohler case, K-O-L-L-E-R, 248 with second 259, and there are others, the McMahon case is another one, that indicate that this type of a right, that is the right to be present during deliberation or communications between a judge and a deliberating jury, is subject to harmless error analysis. So,
I understand that has been a principle in certain Court of Appeals cases. I would suggest that if we are looking at a situation where there is presented at length the videotape we've talked about, mm-hmm. without the judge asking the same questions, what part of the tape didn't you remember? What part of the tape didn't you understand? But provides it wholesale over the objections of counsel. He got something right there. The reality of this to me is that in and of itself, the error arises not just as to the effect, but as to the process or the procedure, the structure. And again, my case here involves a videotape, and I would be hard-pressed to say you should change the total standard for all communications, although it certainly could provide a policy or guidance that would be of help to circuit courts. But to try to put ourselves into the minds of the jury, who saw the tape not once but twice, who then asked for the complainant's cross-examination and the defendant's testimony, which is, to me, the checks and balances of deliberations, and are denied that second part. The prospect of error occurring because the jury is not given what it asked for, to me, is not harmless. The outcome in this case is in doubt. There were inconsistencies I noted in my reply brief. There were contradictions that the jury did not hear a second time. And those are the sorts of things that defendants deserve to have pointed out in the closing arguments and to be reviewed by the jury.
Mr. Hertel, if I could follow up Justice Bradley's question, and it kind of relates to the question I asked earlier. As I understand it, there are two rights that may be at play here. One is the right to be present. And I think, as Justice Bradley has pointed out in her question, not only the Court of Appeals cases from this jurisdiction, which hold that it's subject to the harmless error rule, but I think Rogers versus United States from the United States Supreme Court would suggest the same thing. But that's why I asked the question about the the right to counsel, because it seems that you've got two issues going on here. You've got the right to be present. You've got the right to counsel. And it, at least for me, it might make a difference in terms of which right we're talking about as to whether or not a harmless error analysis can be applied in this case.
And I guess my sense in response is that each of them is indeed impaired by the process that was used here to the detriment of the defendant. Do we know what Jonathan Smith would have done had he been advised of this? In essence, no. We didn't have the Mockner hearing. But what we do know is that almost any attorney advised of such communication who represents a defendant would be saying, you're correct, Judge, let's get those testimonies reread, because that's obviously important to the jury, and if they know the law, defense counsel says, as a matter of fact, pursuant to case law, that's got to go. The absence of that attorney in a position to make those arguments is indeed no counsel at all. And if a defendant has a right to have counsel at trial, that issue is clearly present. If by statute the defendant has got to be there by mandate and isn't there, that is also the violation both of the statute and the constitutional requirement on which the statute is based. Any other questions?
How does, if at all, how does the destruction of the notes fit into this analysis?
And I think the issue there is there is absolutely no one anywhere in this process, from Judge Sankovitz up to this moment, who can say with certainty exactly what the phrase was that was used by the jury in its first request, the judicial response, the inquiry by the jury for the second request, and the second judicial response. We have a recreation, but to me, given the existence of the case law, this is compounding what is already a reversal situation by denying to everyone in the process the ability to understand what happened. The Ronder, U.S. v. Ronder procedure that is described in my original brief in the conclusion is a cure to that particular problem. The inquiries in writing, the court convenes, mark the exhibit that's writing, discuss the options for response, craft the response before the jury's return for any last-minute modifications, bring the jury in and give them the response. That package guarantees that right to counsel would be present, right of the defendant to be present is there, the record would be preserved. Because we're talking about two communications which we can only believe have been accurately reported by Judge Sankovitz in his post-verdict, pre-announcement recitation to the lawyers. But his decision said no one has pointed out that he was wrong in how he described that. Well, no one else was there. I mean, other than conceivably a juror who read the note, and jury deliberations are not allowed in as evidence in post-conviction hearings in terms of their deliberations. I don't believe competent evidence could be utilized by having jurors come and say, here's what was on the note. You're left with, you got to have the note. You got to have the record. And the judge knew that. The first two notes are in the file. They're part of the record because he knew the right thing to do and then switched off or something.
You say the first two notes, you mean the note concerning wanting all of the exhibits coming to the jury room?
Yes, including the video, the VCR and the TV, and then asking for Exhibit 8, the police report that was not put into evidence.
Was that the police report or the summary by the social worker of the video?
I believe that was the police report, because the social worker's report, I believe, was the one that I objected to as not, never having been offered but was accepted by the court, if I recall correctly. I
went to the – oh, okay, maybe I had that mixed up. I thought that the social worker's report went to the jury, although no one offered
– that's correct
– the report into evidence.
Yes, and that issue I had raised in the Court of Appeals, but
– not before
us. Not before the Supreme Court. If there's nothing further, I'll take advantage of my yellow light. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Castle.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle, appearing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. Before I begin my remarks, I'd like to thank the Court and counsel for accommodating my illness a few weeks ago. Greatly appreciate it. There is no disagreement in this case that the trial court erred when it responded to the jury's request to have testimony read back without the defendant's input or knowledge. It has long been recognized in this state that such communications violate a defendant's right to be present at trial and to counsel. The disagreement between the parties lies in how the court should analyze the consequences of that error. It has been the state's position, a position with which the Court of Appeals majority agreed, that because the defendant failed to object when the trial court informed the parties of what it had done, that this case should be dealt with the same way the court deals with other issues of waived claims of error, that is, under the rubric of ineffective assistance of counsel. It is the defendant's contention that the court should directly review his claim of error.
Now, the defendant did object as far as the video, correct?
Yes. I'm referring to
the transcript.
That is a preserved claim of error. To the extent there is a subsidiary argument that not only did the court err by allowing the deliberating jury to view the tape, but the court also erred by sending it to the jury room rather than playing it in open court, there was no objection to the manner. The objection just went to the fact of the claim.
So you're really keying in on the transcript itself and what happened there.
It is, because I think I've always understood that to be the focus of the defendant's argument. Certainly the Court of Appeals did. It dealt with the issue of the videotape just in a footnote.
Let me make sure, clarify with regard to the issues. Now, as I prepared this case, there is a split of authority in jurisdictions and in treatises, I think, as to whether or not a videotape should go to the jury. McCormick, for instance, would suggest no. And there used to be that confessions wouldn't go to the jury, and now written confessions go to the jury by and large, and they're to be treated like other writings. But the videotape, which is the replay of an actual testimony, that's an open question, or at least a question nationally open to debate and among treatises. That issue, that is the procedure, whether or not it should have been played back or how it should have been played back and if they should have been brought into the jury room, to the courtroom if they're going to be played back, there was no objection to the procedure. But there was objection to the tape going to the jury room. Am I making sense in terms of
that?
You know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
So there certainly was an objection, and that's before us, as to whether or not the tape should have gone to the jury room to be played by the jury rather than bringing them out in open court, especially in view of the lack of balance with regard to the two requests for the defendant's testimony and that being given. So that's still an issue before us.
It is.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think a couple remarks. I think it is there are two ways in which the videotape has importance. One is the issue of whether it should have been played for the deliberating jury and secondarily should it have been in open court. The other, I think, distinct issue is whether, given that it was played, was it an error to not also read back the testimony, or did that somehow exacerbate the problem with reading back the testimony? In terms of the way the court...
Can I just stop you for a moment? One reason we have a rule of law about waiver is that if you object timely, and if you adequately explain to the court the grounds for your objection, the theory is that the court can do something about it, can remedy, if it has already made a goof, it can remedy. If it's about to make a goof, it can stop. In this case, it was too late. There was nothing to do. So for the defense counsel to object when the jury brings in its verdict or is about to bring in its verdict, it's gone. The judge can't then let the defendant's testimony go in. Or maybe it can. I mean, so my point is, if I'm right, that there was nothing the court could do about it, why apply waiver in this circumstance?
Well, this was the precise argument I suggested to the court would, I think, be the strongest defense argument to make against the application.
So what's your counter-argument?
The counter is, as I'll shift to the other side of the podium. As a matter of law, it wasn't too late. Now, one may argue whether as a practical matter it was too late. Certainly, as a matter of law, the court may direct a jury to keep deliberating any point up until the verdict has been accepted, and the verdict here had not been delivered, much less accepted by the court.
It had been reached, but
it
not,
had been,
yeah,
that's
but not
right.
accepted.
So defense counsel could have said, Your Honor, I object to the way the court handled this request. It is important to the defense that this testimony be read back. The judge may or may not have changed his mind. The judge may or may not have said, yeah, I think it's too late now. We don't know. In fact, we don't even know whether defense counsel objected to the substance as opposed to the procedure of what the trial court did. And we've all been working on the assumption that had trial counsel been timely notified and had an opportunity for input, defense counsel would have said, yeah, I want that read back to the jury. And in briefing, I have made that assumption, too. It's, in effect, the strongest argument for the defendant. But the absence of a timely objection really leaves us in a vacuum. Defense counsel, for all we know, may have viewed Mr. Anderson's testimony as such a disaster, or at least as so unhelpful, that he was perfectly content not to have it read back. We just don't know.
You haven't had a Mockney hearing.
No. In fact, I noted that in my brief there was no Mockney hearing. So I think if the court were to agree with me that this should be looked at as an ineffective assistance case, but disagree with me on the prejudice issue, then the remedy would be a Mockner hearing, and we could find out.
But your ineffective assistance, even if the court would agree with you that the objection as to being present and having counsel present is subject to ineffective assistance of counsel, you're left with there was an objection made regarding the video being played to the jury. So
that's right. Certainly there was. And that's not would not be subject to a Mockner hearing. But there, you raised the question of, well, this is an open question. And certainly it's an open question in this state. I cited to the court every case I found dealing with this issue, and with the exception of the Ninth Circuit case, which seems to adopt a per se rule that it is an erroneous exercise of discretion to send it back. Every other case, as I read it, and there were about 10 or perhaps 12 cases, said this is a matter for the trial judge's discretion. Now, there were some cases that said it should be done in open court. There are some cases that said it's better to do it in open court, but not necessarily an abuse of discretion to let it happen in the jury room. But the consensus of the cases, with the exception of the Ninth Circuit case, seems to be that it is a matter for the trial court's discretion. And I think we're going to see this, as I was trying to think about the implications of this case, as we start to have defendants' statements now being recorded on a regular basis. We already have now the Jensen case saying within the trial court's discretion the written statement of a defendant can go in. We may see this play out with recorded defendant's statements, too.
The objection here was that I object because, in part, it was, it will unduly emphasize the testimony already given at trial. Right. And that's exacerbated then by the lack of balance.
Well, and I think that's the common concern of the two sets of issues is, was there an undue emphasis? And then you have to, I think, in a sense, look at it in sequence. At the time the judge sent the tape back to the jury, the judge recognized that that was a concern. The judge said, you know, this is an exhibit. I think if the jury wants to see the exhibits, I'll send the exhibits back. But I'm concerned about not unduly emphasizing this, so I'm going to put a restriction on. It can only be played once. No rewinding of the tape. It can be played once. So I think the question is, as I think it is, did the trial court properly exercise its discretion by the decision to allow the jury to view it? I think the answer is yes, because the court was aware of the concern about undue emphasis and used sound reasoning in putting a limitation.
Can you lengthen your question? Did the trial court properly exercise its discretion in letting them view the video while at the same time denying them access to the defense?
Well, and that's part two. Now, at the time it let them view the video, the access, the reading back of the transcripts was not an issue. They happened on separate days. As I prepared for the trial, I saw in my brief, I suggested that the jury's request to have the testimony read back might have happened afterwards on the first day of deliberations. As I reviewed the transcripts again, it's apparent that that all happened on the second day of deliberations, which prompts me to make a point, perhaps important, perhaps not, about the way the court handled the actual written requests and the judge's answers to them. Judge Kessler, in her dissenting opinion, suggested they had been disposed of by a custodian cleaning up. There's nothing in the record to suggest that. For all it appears, the jury tossed them in the wastebasket and, you know, before coming down, at some point in deliberation, before coming down, they may well have been sitting in the trash can in the jury room, and defense counsel, if he thought it was important to get it on the record, as they should have been on the record, might have said, Judge, could you send a bailiff and fish those out of the trash can? But to get back to the question of, did the judge then erroneously exercise his discretion in his response to the questions to have the testimony read back, given that he, the day before, had sent back the videotape? My argument is twofold, is no, he did not. And I think the judge said, you know, I asked the jury, tell me specifically what you want to hear. The jury said, we don't understand. As I pointed out in my brief, the defendant's testimony was limited to a very few topics. He denied anything happened. He discussed his interaction with his wife after he was confronted with the disclosure, and he discussed his travels to and from Kentucky. Now, I don't think it was an impossible task to ask of the jury, as the defense has suggested, have the jury say, we didn't understand what he said about his travels to Kentucky, or we didn't understand what he testified to about his contact with the Milwaukee Police Department. I don't think that was an impossible task. Now, I will acknowledge his testimony was not long. I don't know the timing on it. It doesn't cover a lot of pages of transcript. But I don't think we can say, therefore, because the testimony didn't exceed X number of minutes, the judge doesn't have the discretion to say, let's be specific about what you want.
Well, let's say they said, covered a number of topics, each in a very short time, and frankly, we can't get a handle and repeat in a coherent way what he said.
That would be, if they had come back with that, and he still said, sorry, I would be much harder pressed to argue that was a proper exercise of discretion.
Under the conditions here, it was not out of proper range of discretion to say X number of, well, he doesn't know the number of pages, but it took roughly less than a half hour, would you say?
I don't know, without reading it aloud, I defer to an experienced trial counsel to...
A half a minute slowly of each page will give you a rough calculation on that. And say, well, it's less than a half hour, we can hear the whole thing. I mean, if it was 2 days, you couldn't do that.
That's certainly part of the calculus, but part of the calculus the judge would undertake.
Well, who has the burden of proof here? And then your answer is it depends, right?
Well, it depends on whether the court views this as an ineffective assistance claim, in which case the defendant does, or if it is a claim not subject to waiver. I'd like to get to the question of, regardless of who has the burden of proof, the argument that if it was raised in the defendant's brief, I missed it, but this argument that somehow this is a structural error to which harmless error cannot apply, it's not only the State Court of Appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court that supplied a harmless error. It's this Court in Burton was really the leading case of the modern era.
And the right to be present, correct?
It was both the right to be present and the right to counsel, as I recall. It was, my recollection, it was this same error. It was communication outside the presence of either the defendant or counsel, or communication with the jury. And the State and the Court talk about it both as a violation of the right to be present at trial and the right to counsel.
Counsel, let's assume for purposes of this question that the Court agrees that the harmless error analysis would apply to both. How does this Court get a handle on a harmless error analysis where the error concededly was made by the trial court, the evidence that would be relevant to a determination of harmless error, the notes to the jury and the response, are not preserved by the trial court, so that due to the trial court's error, we do not have a record of the communications that took place? Who should that be held against?
Well, I think it should be held against the defendant because I think the defendant...
But the defendant did not commit the error.
Excuse me?
The defendant did not commit the error.
No, but the defendant didn't object when the jury said we left them in the jury room. The defendant just said, I want those part of the record. Send the bailiff down.
I understand.
I'm sorry.
No.
And when I briefed this case, I thought this might have potentially have happened the day before, but it's clear it happened the same day as the court went back on the record. So the court was not rehashing or dredging up old memories. This was presumably fresh in the court's memory, and I don't think there's any reason to question the court accurately, if not word for word, describe the substance of what it did. And I think in looking at whether the error was prejudicial, I think we look at what, as a result of this, assuming that as a result of the opportunity to try to persuade the court, the defendant lost the opportunity to successfully convince the court to have that testimony wrote back. That's where I say we look at the strength of the evidence. And this case is somewhat unusual in that because this was the victim's testimony on direct came in primarily through the videotape under Section 90808, it's available for a reviewing court to watch. And there's no reason that the court can't watch that just as it would read a transcript. And if you look at that tape, I think a reviewing court, as the Court of Appeal did, would say this was persuasive testimony. This was not an equivocating witness. This was a girl who was very straightforward, who was, after all, relating something that one would not expect an 8-year-old girl to know. There were sexual details that an 8-year-old girl would be highly unlikely to know. In fact, the girl's mother or guardian.
But no matter how powerful the tape would be, if there was an error that really tipped the balance, in other words, it's a question of fairness, you still think that the court can go with harmless error?
Well, I guess the question is, could it have tipped the balance?
Well, the balance, as I see it, has already been discussed. But when you look at now, you assess the testimony of the defendant and you said, well, probably it's a good thing it didn't go in. But we, from our standpoint, it's not just looking here, it's looking down the road, that if we were to say, well, this is okay, this may open up some areas that we don't want. In other words, it seems to me, having been a trial judge, I can't recall, and probably it was in my best interest that I can't, but that there was any time when I ever had a question going into the jury, because generally I didn't know enough about it and I wanted to confer with counsel, and I'm just kidding a little there, but confer with counsel so that they had input on it. But it is a question of basic fairness. And I mean, even if it's overwhelming as you see it, and that may be true, that it's just what message this court would be putting out there.
Well, I guess I disagree with counsel when he suggests that this is sending out a message that it's okay. I mean, finding that an error occurred but that the error was harmless under the particular facts of this case, I don't think sends a message to say, you know, it's not really a problem if you do this, because I no more than in any other case where there is where the error is a serious error as a question of law.
There's a series of errors here. I mean, more than one, possibly.
Well, that one error was repeated. Right. But I don't think, I don't know that it would have made a difference to the defense argument, or that it should to this court's analysis, whether this happened once or twice. It was the same request, essentially.
If you are to prevail, Mr. Castle, what do you think this case will stand for in the legal reports? What will you refer to this case for?
Well, I think it depends on how the court chooses to analyze it. It depends, I think, on whether it may have a significance on how courts in the future look at waiver and under which circumstances the court will say that a waiver will be determinative, or situations in which the court will say we don't deem this an error. So that could be a significant issue. The underlying error, though, this case will not set any new precedent. I mean, we're all here in agreement that what the court did was wrong, and so it's really a matter of teasing out how one determines the consequences of that error.
It just seems to me you have, on the one side, pretty compelling evidence. On the other side, you have some pretty clear error, and if you prevail, there really isn't much deterrence for the repetition of that error.
Well, I think that argument applies equally to any harmless error situation. A lot of times, whether or not we apply a harmless error analysis doesn't depend on how clear the error was, I think it depends on the facts of each case. And I think the facts of this case, because in the State's view, because the evidence, the State's case was so strong, because the defense testimony would have, in the State's view, been of such little consequence in the jury's deliberations, because what the defendant had to say about the incident itself was very short and sweet. It didn't happen.
Mr. Castle, doesn't your argument regarding the strength of the evidence, particularly the strength of the videotape, doesn't that argument cut both ways when you deal with the question of prejudice? Because by sending that back to the jury after you've just talked about how compelling it was and how compelling the Court of Appeals thought it was, doesn't that just highlight the fact that the way it was handled is really prejudicial?
As I thought about it, my first reaction was, this is a sure two-edged sword, isn't it? But as I thought about it, I think the question of whether a piece of evidence was overemphasized really is separate from what the content of that evidence was. So the argument, I think, would be the same if my harmless error argument would be the same, or prejudice argument would be the same, but in terms of whether it was overemphasized or not, would be the same if the girl had given equivocal, unclear, hesitant answers. So I think the overemphasis comes from the manner in which the number of times, for example, the jury might be able to see it. Jury had no restrictions on the tape and played it several times, I think one might say it was overemphasized, even if it was weak testimony. So the answer is, I don't think so. I think it's a separate question, the content of the evidence versus whether it and the strength of it versus whether it's overemphasized or not.
Did the trial court commit error by not retrieving the notes and making them part of the record?
Yes. 805.13 requires communications to be on the record. So those, I don't think 805.13 itself requires that they be.
Retrieve it, but it requires that all communications from the judge and the jury be on the record or made part of the record, I guess.
Made part of the record, yes.
How do we know exactly what the jury did with the videotape?
We don't. And I think, the court directed the bailiff to tell the jury what to do with the videotape. Jurors are presumed to follow instructions. We don't know. There's nothing in the record to say one way or another. We just know what the jury was instructed to do. If the court has no further questions, I will thank you.
Annie, thank you, Mr. Castle. Mr. Hurdle.
I'll try to do sort of a catch-all and maybe start at the end and work my way backwards. The question, what did the jury do with the video, suddenly prompted in my mind things which I sure wish I'd thought of before I got up here today. But in reality, the question deals with, first, there was a communication from the bailiff to the jurors that is not of record. And then, because it was in deliberations with no one present, despite the court's admonition that it not be played more than once and only paused if there was a need to, there is no record of that either. And this case would stand for the fact that that's okay. And in the interest of fairness, I don't believe that is okay. In addition, there was the question about what became of the record, and Mr. Castle suggested that the defense counsel should have, you know, gone to get it. And in reality, the point is that there should have been a record that couldn't be put in a wastebasket because it was done in the presence of the defendant and with his counsel's involvement, so we'd never get to the issue as to is there some responsibility on the part of defense counsel making them ineffective for not saying, well, wait a minute, let's go retrieve something. I would also note there's no proof it was in the wastebasket. Unless we're going to go back and find out exactly when they emptied wastebaskets in the Milwaukee County Courthouse, we're left to the proposition.
I think the judges have to take out their own
wastebaskets. Might be there.
Not going to go there. The reality of it is that's why you make a record. That's why you do it in court. And you don't turn to defense counsel and later say, shame on you for waiving something about retrieving notes that judges created back and forth to jurors off the record. I noted the comment about deterrence. And this is probably the first time I've appeared in 30 years of criminal cases where it occurs to me there is a need for deterrence to courts to make sure that the process is done properly for both sides in the litigation. And in a way, a ruling that says, here's how you have to do it in your communications or else it is a structural flaw that mandates a new trial, will result in it being done right. And you won't have to sit back and look at videotapes or read transcripts and say, well, let's see, is this harmless error because I, who didn't see the witnesses live and in person, conclude that it was harmless beyond reasonable doubt or a harmless error in the ineffective assistance.
Counsel, in order to get to that deterrence, though, don't we have to disregard the cases that Mr. Castle pointed out that says that this exact kind of error is subject to a harmless error analysis?
I believe that you would have to take the parts which are sort of like the parts of that elephant that individually, when graphed by the blind men, look that way, and instead take a look at the totality. And I'm hard-pressed to say that every juror communication goes back to the Havner days, because I think the whole point there was you don't put the mundane on the record. But when it relates to a trial and a significant part of a trial, the procedure should exist. It should be a mandate. And secondly, if there is a videotape or audio tape that's gone to the jury, there absolutely has to be a principle that requested testimony be read, because the tape itself provides part of the case, but the whole desired evidentiary deliberation cries out that they get what they want in that deliberative process. And so the only way to make sure that happens is to let the circuit court know there'll be a new trial if they don't do it.
But that is different from our past case law.
It is. And in a sense, the policy-making role that this court probably, I shouldn't say the word enjoys is right, but that you face cries out for that, just as the juveniles whose confessions are now tape recorded, because it was an important principle and it was a change. And sometimes change hurts, but it's got to be done. One other note, we don't know how long it was between the two notes coming out. There is no record of that. If the first request was sent back and 5 minutes later the note comes back, that may have relevance that isn't as clear as if there was 3 hours in between. And again, that's a point that I think mandates why you put that on the record. I don't think on overemphasis that there is a difference that exists between the issue of overemphasis and the content, because it is the content which creates the evidentiary deliberation. And when you look at that content and you've gotten one side of it and not the rest, it will by itself provide overemphasis. They asked for ML's testimony in court where she said she had never denied this to people before. They didn't get that read to them again. That was relevant evidence that would have had a lot to do with what a jury wants to consider in deciding guilt or innocence, and it never got to them. It seems to me that you can't simply say the content. Oh, I'm done.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hurdle, and thank you, Mr. Castell, for your arguments today in 2004 AP 2010 CR, State v. Anderson. That concludes our hearings for this afternoon. We are on recess until tomorrow morning when at 9:45 we will hear the last three oral arguments, or at least May. We are in recess.
What time did you say?
9:45.
No, I
mean. Oh, the court will meet in closed conference at 3.
Thank
How's
you.
That? 3:10? What do you want?
3:10.
Okay, 3:10. You made it 3:10.